So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight. Oh.
Listen to Review Man.
For 19 years, SummerSlam has been the biggest party of the summer.
See, there's two types of people in this world. Those who fight for pride and those who fight for glory.
Shut up! That's not the way the real John Cena versus Edge story goes, no.
Now, Edge is one of them dirtbag, cut, throw, stamp on your face, piss on your grave scumbags.
And I am sick of getting no respect around here.
You want to get a psychological advantage to SummerSlam?
Every good story needs a grand finale, a great ending, and usually the good guy wins. But this is the real world, son, and I'm throwing on my black hat.
You want the glory of walking down that ramp saying you're the champ?
This story's gonna have a happy ending.
You want respect,
but it's gonna be for me.
Get your ass out here and earn it.
Me press trigger, me no press people button. Nobody chat come face me with some. Like how me have 22 in a me some. Game said them a friend and them bad mind your friend. Anytime you ready.
Welcome to Review Away. It's John Pollock and Wei Ting. And Wei, we're going to get into this later on at the end of the show, but this podcast is going to sound different for the next 3 weeks.
It will, yes, but that is because I am taking a sabbatical. And we will get to... Well, we'll just talk. What? Should we talk about it now or later?
Yeah, we can talk about it now.
Okay. Well, I'm just taking 3 weeks off. I'm going over to Asia to visit family. And
Wait, Asia's a continent.
Yeah, I am.
It's a huge continent.
Well,
where are you going in there?
I'm going to Shanghai and I'm going to go to Hong Kong. Two cities within the continent of Asia. So I was right.
That's like your Japanese cousin saying, I'm going to North America.
Okay, fine. I'm going to Shanghai,
right.
And I'm going to Hong Kong.
Well, how are we going to do this podcast without you?
I don't know. It's up to you. I don't care. Not my problem.
Well, this is unfortunate timing, but you were here for episode 100 last week, and you will be back for our two-year anniversary show in early September.
Mm-hmm.
So in the meantime, there are three shows of which I have gone outside to recruit a guest reviewer for those three shows.
I look forward to it, and I can guarantee that this reviewer will probably be quite knowledgeable.
I hope so, because you're gone. Dan and Jay are unavailable, so I have to go outside of the Law family. And who am I going to recruit?
Who?
And let's not forget, guys, there's Review of Raw, and there's Review and Impact, and I have found three guest reviewers for all of those shows.
Wow.
So tune in for the surprise, everybody.
Yeah. Week after week, day after day.
I'm going to miss you.
I'll miss you as well. I'll miss all of you, all of our listeners. I'll miss all of you.
But you'll be back.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I'll be on Facebook. I'll be listening as well.
Now, I recall that I was in Chicago a few weeks ago, and I told you that I bought you a gift, and I was going to give it to you on the show, and I have forgotten all these weeks.
I forgot you even
got it. It's been in my desk at work.
Okay.
So, I was in Chicago with my friends, Ed and Eric, as you may have heard on our podcast, on Law Extra, and I was at a store, and I saw these, and I thought I would have to buy you one.
Wow. Oh, my God, John. WWF Wrestling Tops trading cards
from 1987, complete with gum inside.
Oh my God. Featuring WrestleMania 3, and there's a drawing of Hulk Hogan on the cover. This is a wax package, and it's worth $250. Can I open this?
Yeah, sure. I would not eat the gum, as it has been in there for 24 years. And it's also, I believe, a health concern now to even sell gum inside trading card packages.
Well, the gum has already...
Why don't you read out who's on the cards?
I'll let you know what cards I have, okay? This is really cool, John. Thank you. There are 9 cards. 1 stick of gum.
Ugh, that gum looks like rock.
Like, I can't even...
Jesus!
Wait, you hear this? This is what happens when you hold gum.
Sounds painful.
You know, if you didn't tell me, I would probably take an attempt at eating it. If I didn't know it was a health concern.
Then you wouldn't be returning on this podcast.
No, I'm just that stupid. So here's what I have. Hulk Hogan!
Wow! That's like getting the Jester's Cap in the Ice Age set for Magic Arts.
Okay. Karate stance.
Okay. It's Ricky Steamboat.
This is Ricky Steamboat with his back turned. And
that's karate, a pose?
I guess that's the karate stance. It's a part of their ringside action. Here's what it says in the back. Karate stance. Ricky the Dragon Steamboat goes into karate position during a match. It's a photo of Ricky Steamboat's back.
Because he's Polynesian.
Right. Next, we have Davey Boy Smith.
Ooh.
Weight, 244 pounds.
He would go over 300 at one point.
Davey Boy Smith is one half of the former championship tag team, the British Bulldogs. The other is the Dynamite Kid. Smith is a gritty competitor with plenty of dazzling moves. He trains unusually hard and has bulging muscles. Show it. Definitely unusual. Next, we got Jason Agnew's favorite, the Honky Tonk Man.
Oh, wow.
Maybe he can sing. Maybe not, but he can wrestle. And finishes off people with a move called Shake, Rattle, and Roll. Okay. Next, we have another ringside action card featuring Hulk Hogan with his knee to the ground. A challenge unanswered. Okay. Oh, it's just him. It's him challenging Andre, I guess. Next is a quarter of what appears to be a larger card featuring Hulk Hogan's waist. That I'm supposed to be completing. And then we have another action card with the Hart Foundation, and it's titled Showing Off. The Hart Foundation struts their stuff as they enter the ring. Very nice. Can't believe kids pay for these. Like, I used to be obsessed with training cards. Next we have one, Hooking the Leg.
Hooking.
Hooking the Leg.
Like Luthez hooking the leg?
The Natural Butch Reed hooks an opponent's leg and goes for the pin. They need a card.
They took random photos and gave captions to them.
Yeah. A belly buster is my next one. And then we have Ref Turn Wrestler Smirking. Danny Davis prepares for a match. Banned for life as a referee by the WWF president. Davis became a wrestler under manager Jimmy Muth of the South Hart.
That's a collector's item because it identifies him as a wrestler.
Ah. Thank you very much, John. That's very nice.
Oh, you're welcome, Way.
You know what? Give this one to Jay. Give the Honky Tonk Man.
All right. Jay. Look at that shot of the Honky Tonk Man.
And you can give Jay this gum, too.
No, that's okay. We can put that in the trash, actually.
Okay.
So there you go, Way.
Very thoughtful of you. I will try my best.
It's a going-away present.
I'll try
Maybe
my best.
Maybe you can get me some All Japan Pro Wrestling trading cards. The Kiritawe.
I'm going to China, John.
Maybe they would. Never mind. Let's go on. I apologize. Are there any Shanghai-based wrestlers?
Not that I know of.
No?
No.
It's a big place.
The Orient Express.
Yep. SummerSlam 2006, Mr. Ting.
Mm-hmm.
We should note, everyone, coming up later in the program, my interview with Alex Greenfield, who was the lead writer of SmackDown at this time period, heading into the pay-per-view. He would be with the company for another 2 months after this before leaving the company. It was great to chat with Alex, and he gives a ton of behind-the-scenes notes about this card and how the SmackDown side was completely rebooked based on the Great American Bash from the prior month. Hmm. And pretty much all your questions you had for Alex Greenfield, he answered, and a lot of interesting stuff that I was not even aware of. So that's coming up after our review, so be sure to stay tuned for that. But here it is, SummerSlam 2006, from August of that year, Boston, Massachusetts, at the TD Bank North Garden, the home of John Cena, who would be in the main event of this show, challenging Edge for the WWE title.
Mm-hmm.
And we see the opening video, where it's basically hijacked by DX, with Hunter and Shawn showing underwater. And then they preview Booker T and Batista, Edge and John Cena. A very good promo from Edge, saying that good guys don't always win, and I wear a black hat.
Good for you.
He's saying he's a bad guy.
Oh. Oh, okay.
That's what black hat means.
Ah.
And our announcers for tonight, we've got three sets of announcers. We had Michael Cole and JBL on SmackDown. Mm-hmm. I'm always happy when we go to review a show and JBL's on commentary.
Huge, huge, huge fan.
He was great on this show. Jim Ross and Jerry Lawler on Raw, and Joey Styles and Taz to call a 8-minute match.
Yeah, pretty much. That, yeah, they're earning their money.
So we kick things off with the SmackDown brand, and we have Rey Mysterio, who had just lost the world title a month ago at the Great American Bash, taking on Chavo Guerrero. And Mysterio comes out. He hands his pendant to this little girl in the crowd, and she just freaks out.
Wow.
Like, she is just in shock.
I would.
Rey Mysterio is giving me something.
I would freak out right now if he did that. If I was ringside. I mean, to be singled out amongst, 20,000 people? He chose you to give his pendant. Quite something. You know what? You know how Ray always, like, does the whole thing with, like, the kids when he walks out, puts his, like, head to the kids?
Be a great heel turn if he headbutted one of them?
No.
Oh.
it would be, but no. It would be many lawsuits coming off of that. But, I always, you know, he only does that to the kids wearing the mask, and so I always feel so sad for the kids that don't have a mask but are standing there waiting to touch Rey Mysterio and waiting for the attention from their hero, Rey Mysterio.
It's like Bret Hart giving the glasses out. I mean, tons of kids want those glasses.
Yeah, yeah, but Rey does it to, like, so many kids, and you would occasionally see him skip over one of the other kids just because they don't. Their parents didn't buy a mask for them. I would hate my parents if they didn't buy me a mask and Ray skipped me over. I would resent them forever.
Well, that's maybe a huge reason for the
merchandise
parent-child divide.
That's, oh, okay.
I was going for a bigger issue in society. We see a video of Eddie Guerrero and Rey Mysterio detailing their friendship, and comes back, and Michael Cole is basically recapping the whole feud, and somehow, Cole was, I don't think he meant to say it like this, but he said the words, Mysterio isn't sucking off anyone.
Oh,
in defense of Mysterio not trying to, I guess, use Eddie as, I don't know. That was the storyline here, was that Chavo and Rey were trying to honor Eddie here. Because we had gotten away from the exploitive storyline, which was right after Eddie's death.
Oh, my God.
This was a more toned-down version.
Okay, but even this, I didn't really watch WWF at this time, despite working up on the law.
You were our calls, Kurt.
I know. I wasn't really watching. I was kind of in my dark period. But I, watching this right now, even, I just found it so really awkward, you know?
It felt awkward to me, too, but I think that's mainly because I knew what other stuff they did involving Eddie that made everyone feel horrible. This I didn't find as bad because it was two guys that are trying to honor their friend, but it's still using Eddie in storyline, but I didn't find it that offensive or exploitive as prior stuff.
Okay.
But after hitting a low point of having a guy actually say Eddie's in hell, it's hard to fall below that point. So we see a video of Chavo and Eddie highlights together, and the match kicks off. Mysterio sends Chavo to the floor and hits a baseball slide and then misses a pescado, and then Chavo hits one of his own, and JBL says that this match is going to be World War III. This match, the opener at SummerSlam, World War III.
That's WCW.
There was a, yes, you're right. There was a sign in the crowd that said, keep Kali off TV. If they said pay-per-view, you could say that the WWE listened, because he was not on this pay-per-view. And JBL then yells, this is why we're the A-team. He had some great gems on this show. And we'll get into that later with Alex Greenfield about some lines JBL was able to sneak in during SmackDown broadcasts that he was always amazed at. There was a loud Eddie chant that begun. Chavo teases a powerbomb to the floor off the top rope, but Rey blocks it, and both go face first into the ring. And then Rey is seated on the top. It goes for a back elbow to Chavo, and then jumps onto the shoulders of Chavo and hits a Hurricane Rana, sending Chavo into the ropes, and he takes the 619. Rey misses a senton, but then hits a Hurricane Rana, and it sends both to the floor. And this is when a much different-looking Vicky Guerrero runs down and starts yelling at Chavo to stop fighting with Rey, and is trying to get him into the ring. Vicky then slaps Chavo, who then gets Is this Rey that gets slapped, or is it Chavo that gets slapped?
She slaps Chavo first. Yeah, and then she bumps Rey afterwards.
That's right. Yep. So they go back into the ring. Chavo hits the Three Amigos, and then Rey hits them himself, and he got some boos for that spot of doing the Three Amigos. I guess the crowd was not cool about him taking Eddie's moves here. And then Rey climbs up as Vicky then gets onto the apron. Rey gets crotched, and then Vicky falls down to the floor, and it looked like she landed badly on her ankle because she was limping after this and landed very awkwardly for a non-trained performer. Mm-hmm. And Chavo then hits the brainbuster and a frog splash, and Chavo gets the win as Vicky limps to the back, and this would eventually lead to Vicky's heel turn on Rey. But at this point, she was still playing a babyface. Much different performer than we see today, a Vicky Guerrero.
A very, very big difference. I mean, and that's saying something about what incredible shape she's in right now, and about just the evolution of her character and her comfort in front of a camera from then to now. I thought it was a good match, but the Vicky stuff I felt at the end was a little bit awkwardly executed, but maybe that was the point, you know, to tease the heel thing.
Yeah, it was a bit muddied at the finish, mm-hmm. but it was obviously leading to the turn with Vicky. King Booker was backstage clutching his title along with Queen Charmel, who walks in and they speak Shakespeare to one another. Booker calls Batista a peasant, and then Edge and Lita come in with their WWE title, and they take offense to Booker and Charmel calling themselves the most powerful couple in sports entertainment, and Booker asks, who is this rogue? I love this Booker character.
Oh, he's hilarious.
He was just awesome.
Great look, and just he just felt like it was so over the top and unreserved, you know? Like he would just go and...
Some felt it was too comedic for him to be the world champion, but I just thought he was so great. He was like, he was the king of this show and should have the title. And I thought, I really enjoyed this character. This, to me, was his character had gotten very stagnant as Booker T, and getting this king character, I just thought it rejuvenated him, and he just took this role so seriously and pulled it off great. I really enjoyed his run.
Very entertaining.
So we have Edge with the WWE title and Lita is the women's champion, and they decide to make a bet that if Edge loses his title, he'll have to kiss Booker's feet, and if Booker loses, he'll have to be Edge's royal servant for one night on Raw. So this was to lead you to believe that one of the titles is going to change. I thought very clever on the company's part doing this. And then we go to our second match, and it's the Big Show against Sabu for the ECW title. This was Rob Van Dam had been suspended in early July and had the ECW and WWE title taken off of him. And he had come back by this point, but was not on SummerSlam, and therefore was a kind of odd man out here. And Sabu got the title shot here against Big Show. And as well, Kurt Angle had been moved over to ECW, and he was a... He was about 5 days away from being released by the company, and he was not in a good situation during this pay-per-view and was not put on the show, which speaks volumes as to the concern they had for Kurt Angle that he was left off SummerSlam.
Wow.
And then that Friday, he was let go. So Sabu defeated RVD in a ladder match at the ECW show from earlier in the week in a number one contenders match to get this title shot against Big Show. And it featured Big Show interfering and attacking both men during the ladder match, but Sabu grabbed the contract as Show was attacking him. So the match starts with Sabu attacking Big Show with chair shots. This is, of course, an Extreme Rules match for the ECW title. It's an Arabian facebuster right away. And then Show puts his foot through the chair after tripping Sabu into the chair. And then Show catches Sabu off the second rope and basically tosses him overhead as he rolls to the floor. And Show gets guillotined from the floor on the top rope. And a chair is thrown into his head and then again into the ring by Sabu. Sabu then accidentally drops the chair to the floor. The crowd boos. And we see a drop kick into the chair onto Big Show. Sabu then brings out a table. He sets it up in the corner inside of the ring, and then we saw a very sloppy bulldog off the top by Sabu, who then jumps off a chair to faceplant Big Show through the table in the corner, and this did get an ECW chant.
That's what makes Sabu Sabu, though. It's just complete...
He's reckless.
Complete recklessness, you know?
I just... If I watch Sabu wrestle a technically perfect match, I think it would take away from him.
It wouldn't be right. No, no. He just... He doesn't really... Well, he probably thinks about it quite a bit, but it feels like this guy... Yeah, he's supposed to be crazy and just... sloppiness is part of the...
I think it was Mikey Whipwreck or Lance Storm who once brought up how Sabu said beforehand that he would purposely fuck up spots to fuck with the audience.
Really?
He's like, whatever, okay. Whatever suits you.
All right.
So maybe this was what he was going for. We see an electric chair by Sho, and his forehead is cut at this point, and he follows up with a Vader bomb, and then the Big Sho selling his ribs upon landing with the Vader bomb. Sho tosses the steel steps into the ring, sets both of them into the ring, as well as a table, puts the table onto the steps, and then Sabu stands on it. It falls off of the steps, and he has to reset it, and he goes for this DDT to Big Sho through the table, but the spot just didn't flow well. Like, he jumped up, Big Sho looked like he was going to put Sabu through the table, and then he turned it into a DDT, and it was just a bad angle it was shot at, and I don't think the crowd knew what Sabu had done with the DDT spot. And it leads to Sabu setting up a table, and Sabu springboards off of it into Big Sho, who chokeslams Sabu through the table, and he gets the win, 8 minutes and 29 seconds. Not a great match. This was kind of just your 8-minute let's-use-tables-and-chairs match.
Yeah, not a great match, but, you know, you saw a lot of tables broken, and as a hardcore match, I thought it was pretty good. I thought Sabu was good, and I like the Big Sho a lot in this type of match, because his size works well with the style, because, like, he's almost indestructible. You know, you can put him through, like, 15 tables.
But these were the kind of matches that really fucked up his back, where he'd have to take a significant period of time off. And I think it was that run in ECW that really wore his body down. I mean, this is a big guy taking some big spots in these matches. Then Jim Ross and Jerry Lawler throw to the Hard Rock Cafe for the Diva Search, where our winner of the $250,000 grand prize was Layla. Spent with the company 5 years.
Did they call this the Diva Search, or didn't they call it the sexiest woman in the world or something?
Yeah,
like that?
They had the tagline for it. I think they called it both. But yeah, the sexiest woman on television.
Okay.
Layla. So we go backstage, and Trish Stratus is with Maria, Candace, and Kelly. And they bully Layla. And then the women, first she comes in, and they ignore her. And then we see Tori Wilson, Jillian Hall, and Ashley Massaro also there. And Trish cuts a promo on Layla about whether Layla thinks she can be a diva simply by winning a contest. And Trish says that, "I've lost a knuckle." And she goes through why Tori should be in the WWE, why Jillian should, and why Ashley can be a diva. And it all leads to them just joking and saying, "We're just kidding. You can be a diva." And then they take her into the shower and spray her, and then they hike up her skirt to reveal a thong.
Mm-hmm.
So this is her initiation. Basically, this is... Imagine if the guys did this. This would be sexual harassment.
Well, sure.
But girls do this all the time.
Yeah, because...
They take other girls into the shower.
Of course. I was waiting for the music to pipe in and for all of them to start taking their clothes off. It felt just like a porn.
They were waiting for that to come on.
Okay. Yeah, no, it felt like a really good porno.
They could have played Cobra Style here, the theme music for the show.
Cobra Style.
That was that Teddy Bears. It was the theme song for this.
Oh, for this. Okay.
I don't know what is the song title and which is the band, but I know it's...
The band's called Teddy Bears.
Okay, and the song is called Cobra Style.
Okay. Anyway, so, she wears a thong, and we got to see it.
Great. Welcome to the WWE, Layla. So then we get a video on Hulk Hogan returning, featuring old and new clips, and then the angle with Randy Orton giving a rose to Brooke, the now nude Brooke.
Oh, wow. Speaking of pornos.
You realize Brooke was 18 at the time of this angle.
Wow.
She's 23 now, and naked.
Okay. Is she completely naked?
I think so. It's for PETA. They can talk you into anything.
Okay, she's probably holding her breasts.
They wouldn't advertise it as Brooke poses nude.
Yeah,
if it was just that.
Sure they would. Why would PETA show completely nude? I don't think PETA would do that. That doesn't send a message. John is Googling Brooke Hogan nude right now.
Brooke Hogan doing this at work, too. Nude photo. Brooke Hogan nude pics.
And what do you see?
Let's see. I think a lot of these are fake.
You know what? Let me take part in this research as well.
You're better at finding this stuff
Brooke
than me.
Brooke Hogan.
They were supposed to unveil it today, because today's Hogan's birthday.
Two guys, Hulk
is going to be attending this unveiling of her nude picture. Would that be something you'd invite your dad to?
Well, it seems like he's quite proud, so why not? And if my...
For the ethical treatment of Brooke.
I don't see any... I see a few nude photos of Brooke Hogan, but they're very questionable, because they're much more graphic than what I think PETA would do. So we could probably assume that they're not from PETA. And I don't see any others, so... I guess it hasn't been revealed yet.
I guess not. I'm sure Hulk will post it on his Twitter as soon as it's up.
Yeah, okay. Two guys looking for nude photos on their laptops in a closet together.
At work. It's our job, boy.
Yeah.
It's our job.
Yeah.
Okay, so we can't find it. But it's happened. I'm sure by Sunday everyone will have found it.
Yeah, we'll keep looking.
Okay, so anyway, how did we get into that? Oh, right. Randy gave Brooke a rose in this angle. And this was weird because Hogan wanted to use Brooke to, A, they wanted to promote their reality show, but B, he also wanted to help Brooke push her album, which was just being released around this time. And I think the original plan someone had batted around was Brooke joining Randy and turning on Hulk, and they didn't want, and the record label didn't want Brooke to be a heel on television because fans won't buy CDs of a heel Brooke Hogan. Little did they know fans wouldn't buy a album from a babyface Brooke either. So it was really an absolutely non-logic argument.
Uh-huh.
So anyway, this kind of we saw Brooke, but she really wasn't a factor in this storyline leading up to the show. And there was the Saturday night's main event angle where it led to Randy challenging Hogan. Hogan accepted, and then Randy RKOs Hogan on his car. And we got Brooke's unbelievable acting where she runs in about a second later and just says, "Randy, what happened to him?" As he's just laid out here after the RKO.
Ridiculous.
And then we get a montage of legends being RKO'd, including Jake Roberts. This was also where the Orton Knows Best sketch was led up to this match with Larry Sweeney, who was played Nick Hogan.
Oh, okay. Cool. I didn't see it.
So, oh, yeah. I keep saying, like, you'll remember this. You weren't watching wrestling at this time.
Mm-mm.
Which I wasn't even aware of.
No, I wasn't. I guess I was watching ROH, working here.
Yeah.
And wrestling at the Chase.
You went to WrestleMania earlier this year.
Did I?
This was 2006.
I completely forgot.
In Chicago.
Oh.
Featuring CM Punk in the main event.
Okay.
So here we go. Third match in. Randy Orton and Hulk Hogan. When was the last time Hulk Hogan worked third?
I don't know.
Hogan, about a week before, had injured his knee. And there was concern if this guy would be ready. And, of course, everyone joked that, oh, that meant he was told the finish of the match, that he wasn't going over, and thus... pop goes my knee. But Hogan made it. He made it here to the show.
Mm-hmm.
And Hogan got the biggest pop thus far in the show. Not surprising. They say he had a torn knee ligament coming into the show. And Ross says, let's see if Hogan's veteran body can hold up. And just looking at these two together in the ring, I mean, this is ridiculous.
It is so ridiculous.
Hulk Hogan and Randy Orton. Hulk Hogan, who would have been 53 at this match.
Hulk Hogan, who is on my trading card from 1987, one of those years.
All right, so 19 years.
And it's just, I think it's especially weird because Hogan is playing his 80s character, and Orton is this modern, cool heel, but yet Hogan is the babyface, but doing the 80s babyface gimmick. With his 80s style of promo.
Yeah, Randy, even at that point, I mean, the guy was pretty built at the time, but you compare him to what he looks like now, like he's extremely more lean.
Huge difference.
I mean, he had like some fat in his face back here.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's
I think it's a better look right now.
Yeah.
He has something different, and I don't know, Better for...
The Natural, Randy Orton.
Okay. Better for, I think, his new character, which is more of a, like a cerebral type of character.
We get the usual collar and elbow tie-up spot that we always see with Hogan's big matches. Hogan starts attacking Orton with the most basic of offense, and it featured this great line from Hogan where he was attacking Orton, and he yells, "How much do you want to take out Brooke Hogan now?" I would never ever identify my daughter by her first and last name.
Yeah, yeah. Imagine that, having to wrestle the father of the girl that you're interested in so that you could date her.
I'm sure they've done that storyline before,
yeah,
maybe.
I'm sure they have.
Hunter and Vince.
Okay. Oh, my God. Wrestling is so weird. You know, yeah, very typical Hulk Hogan offense, but this crowd was so into it.
They wanted to just see Hulk Hogan be Hulk Hogan.
Yeah, yeah, a total nostalgia act, which, again, I feel like, you know, this type of match is a good high-profile match for Orton, but...
Was it really, though? This match did nothing for Orton.
Okay, oh, did not, that's what I'm saying. Like, I feel like the role that... It did nothing to help his character, you know?
Orton attacks the left knee of Hogan to get the heat, and then we see shots on the apron. Orton then misses a cross body off the top rope. Orton ducks the big boot and counters with a big drop kick to a loud set of boos, and then we saw this long wait as Hogan was just climbing up, using the ropes, finally turned around and took the RKO. I really like this, where people got to anticipate the RKO. But Hogan gets his foot on the ropes as the referee counts three. And his hand hits the mat for the three, but the match is not over, and they rule that his foot was on the rope. And then Hogan makes a comeback with the big boot. We saw a long hesitation, and finally he hits the leg drop as Orton just had to play dead for like a full minute. And Hogan gets the win, 10 minutes and 58 seconds. The crowd goes nuts for Hogan here. They show a big dude on the outside who had a Hulk Hogan tattoo on his back as he was leaving. Hogan got a phenomenal reaction. But this was Hogan's last match with the company. He didn't come back. And at the time, they were planning to do something with Hogan at the following WrestleMania, which would have been 20 years after the Andre match. I think that they wanted to do Hogan Big Show, and that's when the whole blow-up with Hogan and Vince occurred.
Okay.
So they at least did have a plan at that time. They were talking about Austin maybe coming to work Hogan, so they at least had plans, but... This really did sacrifice Orton on this evening.
Not only did it sacrifice, it buried him. Like you said, after the big boot, he poses forever before dropping the leg.
There's a way to go over a guy, and there's a way to really hurt a guy.
Absolutely.
And Hogan was out to just, I am Hulk Hogan.
Yeah, man. I don't know why Orton was bothering working on Hogan's leg the whole time. It played absolutely no factor for the rest of the match.
The old man with one leg beat the young upstart Randy Orton.
He used the injured leg to drop onto him, to attack him with.
Not a good night for Randy. But, you know, watching this, it was like, is there ever such thing as really burying someone at this point? Like, no one remembers this match with Randy Orton and Hulk Hogan.
Okay, but, yeah, but Randy certainly didn't gain any momentum.
Oh, no, not at all. I'm just saying that... It's not like this match was a career killer for Randy Orton, which if you just watch this as it happened, I think I'd be more outraged if this match happened tonight. Mm-hmm. And I'd be like, what are you doing with Randy Orton? What a horrible idea. But here we are 5 years later. Randy's fine.
They managed to be persistent with him, and he managed to reinvent his character and continue in the top, sure. But isn't the goal to continue to ascend the level of your character?
I'm sure in hindsight, if they knew this would be the last time they'd have Hogan here, they would have had Orton kill this guy. Mm-hmm. And Hogan would have a second knee injury, and Randy Orton would be doing an interview. So anyway, we get highlights of a pre-SummerSlam blowout to announce their partnership with Comcast for 24/7, featuring pausing, but never fast-forward.
I don't think I saw that.
Oh, maybe this was... I watched the DVD, so okay. They included this on there. Then Mick Foley's backstage with Melina, who comes up to hug him. And
what was the storyline there?
The storyline was that Mick Foley was a mind reader and said, 5 years from now, you're going to be fired. at the time...
Explain this to me.
I'm trying to remember this storyline. Mick Foley had this idea to try and get Melina over by attaching Melina to Mick Foley, and the storyline got completely messed up, and it's detailed in Mick Foley's third book, The Hardcore Diaries, where he talks about what his initial plan was and what actually happened, but suffice it to say, they didn't come close to what he was hoping for. It
seemed like a very odd pairing.
Yeah, it was an odd pairing. I think Foley saw a lot in Melina that she could have been a lot more than simply the manager of Eminem, and I think everyone looked at her as someone at least athletic.
Mm-hmm. Different look.
She had a very good look, but she just never really got to that next level as a female.
Hmm.
So
maybe as a male, she'll do better.
Yeah.
Is that
what would her name be? Melvin? I don't know. What would the male version of Melina be?
I don't know.
Malene?
let's start this again.
This is why we have, I don't know.
Let's pick up again.
No. This is live. This is what you'll miss for the next 3 weeks, everybody.
Oh, boy.
So, Mick is back there. They talk about Ric Flair giving Mick a look that he has never seen before on ECW this past Tuesday. And Melina says that maybe the match isn't a great idea, because I associate myself with winners, and if you lose, Mick, you'll make me look bad. Mm-hmm. This is the babyface.
Sure.
Foley says that the look Flair gave him will be nothing compared to what Foley does to him tonight, and he walks off, and Melina smiles. So I guess we're to believe that she was doing this to motivate him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was actually tough to tell, not knowing the storyline beforehand, who actually was the babyface or the heel in this match.
It was kind of Mick started. No, both were. Mick was the babyface at the start of this.
I'll explain more later, but it just seems so natural to look at Ric Flair as this old man in his 60s as the underdog, the babyface here.
Yeah, but I always think of Ric as, I mean, this man was this crazy 60-year-old.
Okay, but not crazy enough to really pose a real threat, in my opinion. But I guess, you know, they did their best.
I know that Mick was not super high on this match, but the promos going into this were awesome between these two. They just went at it on their promos back and forth. It was a great build-up for this. The match, well, let's discuss it. Foley immediately attacks with forearm shots and a running knee to the corner. Did we mention this is an I Quit match?
Not yet.
Okay, it's an I Quit match.
Sure.
And therefore you have to say I quit. Lawler clarifies, actually comes in on commentary to clarify that Melina provided a pep talk to Foley and therefore was not a heel. So bravo on that backstage segment. Foley pulls out his sock and uses it on Flair, and then he wraps the barbed wire around the sock, but then Flair grabs the testicles of Mick and fights back. Flair puts the barbed wire sock on, and he attacks Foley, and they go to the floor.
He chops him with the barbed wire sock.
Yeah, he chopped them. I mean, this was a very violent match. Foley is sent into the steps.
It's worked barbed wire. Not real.
It was probably a worked version. They had used real barbed wire in the WWF one point.
Yeah. Why? I think the fake
why?
Stuff.
Why? Why would Bill Goldberg insist on real glass when he punches a limo? I'm not going to explain why.
Yeah.
Why?
Why do they use a real steel?
Why would a guy with bad knees get thrown into steps repeatedly?
Sure.
Foley brings out a barbed wire board, and at this point, Flair is bleeding. Almost like 3 minutes into this match, he is bleeding.
Mm-hmm.
And
it looks great, of course. Like within seconds, it's all over his face.
So we've got barbed wire socks. We have a barbed wire bat. We have a barbed wire board. We have blood from Flair. What does the crowd respond with? We want fire, which I guess they had kind of spoiled them because they had started to use fire on those ECW reunion shows, and therefore the crowd was like, more fire.
Ah, that's it? Barbed wire?
Come on, we want fire. Oh, we want guns. Ross brings up that he called the Flair Funk I Quit match in 1989 as well as the Foley Rock I Quit match in 1999. Unfortunately, he would not be present to call the Sting Kurt Angle I Quit match. No, sorry, that was the empty arena match they showed on TV last week. Foley lands on top with a barbed wire board, and Flair just has the complete Crimson Mask at this point. Flair won't quit. Then Flair is dropped on thumbtacks. Nothing more depressing in wrestling than watching Ric Flair take back bumps on thumbtacks.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't want to see that.
See, this is what I'm saying. Flair was working as the babyface here. He was taking all this punishment from Foley.
They put him on an ECW show a few months before this with Big Show, where he did the thumbtacks on TV, and I just thought at the time, this is crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Just nuts. Flair attacks with the barbed wire bat into the left arm of Foley, and then Flair starts yelling at Foley to quit, or, quote, "I will kill you right here." Flair runs into Foley with the bat. Foley flies off the apron. This was the sickest spot of the entire match. Foley flies off the apron backwards, and the back of his head crashes into a garbage can on the floor.
Mm-hmm.
Holy fuck.
I'm guessing he was hoping for the garbage can to break his fall, like to land on the garbage
can. His head broke the fall on the garbage can.
Mm-hmm.
And I can guarantee you, if Mick Foley is having problems with his head right now, spots like that, I'm sure, sped up the process.
Mm.
I mean, it was such a wake-up call when Mick visited our offices last year, and he was telling us all the problems he's having right now.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all because of stuff like this, which, you know, these guys weren't aware at the time of, you know, head damage.
Mm-hmm.
And this is nuts. This spot, I completely had forgotten the spot.
It was really, yeah, very unnecessary.
I felt sick watching this.
You had barbed wire. You had thumbtacks.
This spot. And amazingly, it was like, it wasn't even one of, I think, the memorable spots of the match.
Mm-hmm.
It was just, but an incredibly dangerous spot here. If you guys have not seen this, this was just too much. Landing on the back of your head, which is the absolute worst part of your head to hit, combined with falling off the apron and landing from a certain height.
Mm-hmm.
So Flair basically, he knocks him off, and they call for the bell and say it's over. But Flair grabs the mic and says, "This isn't a lay-on-your-ass match." And Flair picks up Foley, throws him into the ring, and Foley rolls through the thumbtacks after being sent into the ring, and the crowd just groans watching this painful display of violence put out before them. And the match continues, with Melina coming out to ringside, and they use the barbed wire bat. Rick threatens to rip Mick's eye out of his head as Melina is crying. Let's repeat that line. God damn it. Has this company morphed in 5 years? He used the barbed wire bat and threatened to rip his eye out of his head.
Mm.
So Melina's crying. Melina throws in the towel and says he quits. But Flair says that she doesn't quit for him and continues the match again. And he goes to attack Melina with the bat, but Mick quits so that Melina is saved. And Ross questions if we will ever see Flair or Foley in a marquee position at an event like this. He worded it very well to say this is not going to be the last match from either of these two. But a bit of a, I don't want to say confusing finish, but I think an anticlimactic finish.
I thought the match itself was good. I thought
violent.
Yeah, and that's what, obviously, that's what you want. A lot of very memorable spots, and it's just amazing to see this man, this 60-year-old man's penchant for punishment at this age. It's quite something to see. I think their use of gimmicks was good throughout to make up for whatever limitations both had with their bodies. But I did feel that the roles were somewhat incongruent with their storylines. I don't know why. Like Flair was selling so much. I guess it's because they wanted to. They just wanted to let this old guy get hurt for the spectacle of it. Yeah. I thought it was entertaining, though. I really liked this part.
And from there, we go backstage, and Vince is with Shane and Armando Estrada. And Vince calls Foley a loser, but Umaga is a winner, and he's undefeated, and says that he may be the greatest monster in the WWE. And I thought Estrada was great here. Just a terrific manager for that short time. Well, not short time. He was there for about 2 years, 2.5 years on the main roster. But anyway, great to see Estrada here. And then they go back to commentary. And JBL says that Estrada will never get over in a stupid white hat. Next up, we have the SmackDown main event with King Booker defending the world title against Batista. King Booker comes out with Charmel. And this had been basically rushed because of they were supposed to not even touch until the season premiere of SmackDown on the CW network, but everything got rushed because of problems with the Great American Bash Show, and I'll let Alex Greenfield explain that more than I will here. And the match starts off with a spinebuster by Batista. He goes for the Batista bomb early, but Booker rolls to the floor, and JBL makes a joke about saying, "I was at the photo shoot, and thank God they used the photo before the fight." Alluding to the issues here between Booker and Batista. Were you aware of this?
No.
Of the photo shoot?
No, what happened?
Well, Batista definitely had some heat when he came over to SmackDown. He had done an interview calling SmackDown the B-team, and some guys aren't as motivated. And it basically, and I don't know what else was also probably an issue for some of the SmackDown talent with Batista, but it all came to a boiling point at this SummerSlam photo shoot where Booker and Batista went into a room, and essentially Booker beat the fuck out of Batista. And Batista showed up at TV later that day with bruises on his face, and these two had to still work together. And they did, but there was this legitimate fight that occurred at the SummerSlam photo shoot.
Wow.
So, some interesting
and
backstory
JBL mentioned
there.
This.
JBL mentioned in the commentary about the photo shoot. We see Ty clinches with knees by Booker, and then Batista comes back with a belly-to-belly suplex. The referee is distracted by Charmel, and Booker then brings a scepter from the side and breaks it over the head of Batista. And this was just like a regular transition spot, breaking this what golden scepter over the head. It smashed into a million pieces like your gum, and nothing. Batista sold this for like 20 seconds, and then it was right back to getting the heat. So it builds up to Batista eventually hitting a jackhammer, which, surprise, surprise, began a Goldberg chant. I don't know if they were trying to bring Goldberg back at this point, if they were trying to send a message here, but I thought it was kind of a dumb spot in hindsight and foresight, because you're automatically going to get the crowd to think of Goldberg and not focus on your title match here, and was just kind of an odd spot to throw in the middle of this match here. Batista then hits a full Nelson slam. He calls for the Batista bomb, but then Charmel just runs in, attacks Batista for the cheap DQ finish, 10 minutes and 31 seconds, and the fans chant bullshit. And you can't really blame them here. A really lame finish.
Yeah, I didn't think this was a very good match. I thought both men were quite awkward together. And there were just very long rest spots in this. There are like two rear chin locks that just seemed to last forever.
Yeah, it was simply one of those matches where it was like, this is not the end of the storyline. We just have to get through this match. But I thought even with that conclusion that you needed to get to, or at least obviously extend this program, there's a million different ways you can do a finish without just simply Charmel runs in and attacks Batista for the DQ. It's just it's a shitty finish for a pay-per-view, much less a major pay-per-view. Triple H and Shawn Michaels are then...
Oh, you missed the Batista bomb afterwards.
Oh, right. Afterwards, he gave Booker a spinebuster and a Batista bomb.
Well, he tried to give Booker a Batista bomb, and then he nearly dropped him.
Yeah, he said, get a photo of this. So Triple H and Shawn Michaels are then in the men's locker room in a segment that made no sense, and they're talking to someone who we cannot identify, and they're talking to them...
It made sense.
Did it?
Sure. We're talking to Kane.
Oh, that's right. That's right. It does make sense.
Yeah.
I totally blanked on that. They were talking to the mystery, Kane, about how Vince told Umaga that he was the best monster in the WWE, and the mystery guy is pissed. And I was just wondering, how did Triple H and Shawn Michaels hear this conversation? Were they watching it on pay-per-view?
They must have been watching.
I don't know
why Brooke wasn't watching when Randy RKO'd her father onto a hood of a car.
Well, Brooke was dizzy.
Okay.
Ross then tees up perhaps the most anticipated tag match in SummerSlam history, surpassing Randy Savage and Zeus teaming up to take on Hogan and Beefcake.
That's big.
And then we see a video recapping the DX McMahon's feud, which featured the Vince Loves Cox shirt.
Oh, my God.
Which I can say I know at least one person bought this shirt.
Yeah, we both do.
Radar.
Radar.
From O'Grady's bought this shirt.
Yeah, and he used to wear it all the time.
That is the only documented time I have seen this shirt in public. And to my understanding, if you asked me to guess how many shirts were sold of that, I would guess one. That's maybe the worst shirt in WWE history.
Yeah, I don't...
Vince loves cock.
You know what? I would say more than that. Well, obviously more than that. But I would say it might have not been that bad of a seller. It seemed like they were catering very much to kids here with this type of humor. I don't know who would buy a shirt like that, though, even if you did find it funny.
This video featured Vince dancing, DX fucking with audio equipment, Vince and Shane smoking cigars, which is funny because Vince detests smokers, Hunter arrested for smuggling cigars, with a piano number underneath, and Umaga working for the McMahons.
And DX dropping shit onto the McMahons.
It was quite the metaphor of the Spirit Squad being shit on.
Right.
By DX.
This feud was...
I hated DX when they came back in 2006. I thought all these segments were so lame. It did spike a buy rate when they did the reunion at the June Vengeance show. So I'm not one to say this is completely stupid. People were wanting to see this team reunite.
And how were their merchandise?
It sold well. Yeah. So I don't have much of an argument. I'm just saying personally, I hated this stuff.
Sure.
I thought it was so lame. It was not appealing to... I would have been how old at the time? 22.
Mm.
I just found this was designed for a much younger audience than me.
Maybe a younger audience that would pay for their shirts.
Sure. So anyway, that's our next our co-main event of SummerSlam. Way Triple H and Shawn Michaels against Vince and Shane McMahon. And Ross brings up that Michaels made his SummerSlam debut in 1989 in a six-man tag.
Hmm. Wow.
Some companion programming there to check out Review Away from last week to see how Shawn did in that very first SummerSlam appearance. And the McMahons come out, and then they bring out the Spirit Squad, who just in passing they noted were the tag team champions. And they came out to get squashed by Hunter and Shawn, just laid out like the Putty Patrol.
Mm-hmm.
This poor group.
Oh, well... Come on, how over can a group of six people?
I enjoyed the Spirit Squad when they debuted.
Yeah, well, I don't know if they had too much longevity hoping.
Well, it was a shitty gimmick, but
yeah.
I thought these guys did about as good as they could as male cheerleaders.
Okay.
Then they bring out Mr. Kennedy, William Regal, and Finley, and Finley hits Hunter with the shillelagh, but DX fights them off and sends them to the floor. Then the Big Show comes out. And Show takes down Michaels as the SmackDown heels lay out Hunter on the floor. And we see Hunter chokeslam through the ECW announce table. And this is pretty much the only way Vince and Shane could get heat on DX was by having... We had nine people come out to
more
help.
Than that, right?
We had five Spirit Squad members, okay. Three SmackDown heels. That's eight. Big Show.
Oh.
And then if you include the McMahons, okay. 11 on one. 11 on two.
Sure. And it worked. That's how you would do it.
Yep, this was, they work over Michaels in their corner at the start as Hunter is just laid out on the floor by the table and no one's checking on him. Vince and Shane hit the heart attack on Michaels and Ross compares Shane to Bret Hart. I often confuse the two.
the McMahons just kept doing these double team tag team moves, like that demolition backbreaker elbow drop that we saw. And they would even do the doomsday device. I thought this was very funny. Very fun.
Yes. Part. Shane McHitman. And from there, after the doomsday device, we saw Hunter come back in. DX gets control. We see a top rope elbow drop to Vince by Shawn. And then a clothesline sends Shane to the floor with Michaels. And then Umaga comes down, 12 on 2, and attacks Hunter. And this is when Kane comes out. I totally didn't make the connection between this. So you're correct, Way. And Kane fights off Umaga, and Vince gets a near fall on Hunter. Vince then lays out the official after the near fall, and this leads to a Van Terminator attempt by Shane. He goes to jump off the top rope into the garbage can, but in midair, Shawn Michaels catches Shane with the sweet chin music. This looked awesome.
It did.
The replay was even better. This could not have been timed better.
The camera angle was perfect, too, because Michaels, you didn't even know was up. He was just got into frame, and the timing
best spot of the entire pay-per-view.
Timing was perfect.
It was fantastic. Mm-hmm. And then Hunter hits a garbage can to Vince. He then takes the sweet chin music and a pedigree. DX gets the win, 13 minutes and 2 seconds. I thought this was booked very well. Mm-hmm. And the sweet chin music spot to Shane was just awesome. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So crowd was into this. And as DX was leaving, Hunter does the mock hand to the ear, mocking Hogan. And then they do the DX pose.
Hmm.
And it was no secret that DX, not big fans of Hogan, and I'm sure Hunter was just ecstatic that Hogan was brought back for this pay-per-view and going over Randy Orton in such clean fashion.
Yeah. JR at the end says, it's almost like you just saw 2 or 3 matches in one. So more value for your pay-per-view.
Okay, JR, if you say so. They aired a promo for WrestleMania 23, and they really built this video around the Hogan-Andre match from WrestleMania 3 and how they're returning to Detroit at Ford Field, but of course that would fall apart. They wanted to do Hogan and Big Show to kind of relive that match, but did not happen. And neither would work WrestleMania. And from there we head to our main event, and we got a video recapping the Edge-John Cena match as Edge narrates the story of their feud, including a twist where he lost the WWE title at the Royal Rumble after 3 weeks. And then there was the angle involving Cena's dad being slapped by Edge on the go-home show. And this was all underneath, or had a generic electric guitar bed underneath the footage here.
Okay.
So they announced that if Edge is disqualified in this match, then he loses the title.
Yeah. Similar to the Christian match
yes.
we just saw.
So here we go. Edge and John Cena for the WWE title. We're in Boston, Cena's hometown theoretically, but he still got a mixed reaction coming out. This was especially late 2005, early 2006 is when Cena was just getting massacred by the audience. Mm-hmm. And it was the Edge program that really shifted things back to where they booed Edge and got behind Cena. There was even a sign here, if Edge wins, we riot, which was a fantastic turnaround. The company obviously wanting Cena to be their top babyface, but this was when the mixed reactions were really at least quieting down from the prior couple of months.
It always surprises me to see that in the guy's hometown. You know?
Well, yeah. Why should that be a rite of passage that we like you because you happen to be born near us?
Because that's what usually happens. But I guess people, they're just...
Boston didn't want him.
They don't want to be represented by this guy.
So, I found it was a small and vocal segment that were anti-Cena, but definitely a minority.
Yeah.
Lita was wearing this ridiculous top that I think was glued to herself.
There had to have been tape.
Maybe she was auditioning for PETA.
Maybe. Or maybe she was about to get initiated again in the locker room.
Edge hits a drop kick, knocks Cena off the apron to the barricade. Edge gets the heat. He stops Cena on the top rope and goes for a superplex, but then Edge headbutts Cena off, hits a flying clothesline off the top. We got dueling chants for Cena. And then Edge applies the camel clutch, and Ross makes an Iron Sheik comparison. So we have Shane McMahon compared to Bret Hart, and Edge compared to the Iron Sheik. Cena hit this really shitty mid-ring blockbuster, and then fires up for his comeback, and the crowd got into Cena for his comeback. He hits the five-knuckle shuffle, but Edge counters the FU with an impaler DDT for a near fall. And then Edge goes for an electric chair. Cena counters with a victory roll for a two count, and then we see a roll through on a cross body by Cena, who then stands up and lifts up Edge, puts him on his shoulders for the FU, but Edge gets off, shoves him, and then runs into Lita, and we see a roll-up for a near-fall spot. Edge goes for the spear. It's countered with the STFU. And Lita teases hitting Cena with the title, but Edge pleads for Lita not to because then he'll be disqualified. And then Edge reaches the ropes. Crowd was super hot by this point.
But I thought Lita teasing the interference was really goofy. Like, why would somebody knowingly do that, knowing what was at stake?
I think they wanted to make it similar to the Booker-Batista finish, where Booker just kept his title because his valet just randomly ran in and he saved the title.
I understand, but why?
But he can't because
Lita knows that by interfering she would cost the title.
Maybe she forgot.
Okay. Well, then that would be sloppy either way.
And well, Edge was warning her, don't.
I'm just saying the booking of this didn't really do anything for me and could just took me out of the match because I didn't buy it for a second.
Well, this allows Lita to send brass knucks to Edge. We see an FU attempt by Cena. Then Lita runs in. Cena picks her up, and both are on top of Cena's shoulders. No DQ here for Lita running in, even though we had seen earlier that Charmel running in caused a DQ. Bit of an inconsistency there. And then Lita is sent off the shoulders of Cena. The ref checks on her as Edge then gets off the shoulders, clocks Cena in the back of the head with the brass knucks, and Ross is just irate. Yelling, Jesus Christ! And then Edge is able to get the win after hitting the brass knucks to the back of the head. And Edge is the winner, as JR calls him a son of a bitch. And the show finishes with Edge French kissing the title and then walking to the back with Lita.
Despite the criticism about that Lita thing, I enjoyed this match. I thought the last 5 minutes or so were excellent. And, you know, watching this, you really have to respect John Cena's timing in the ring. I think he does very well with his physical limitations.
And this was only like 2006. I mean, I think the guy's gotten better.
Yeah.
When you're looking back, especially 2005, I mean, there is a marked improvement in Cena over the last like 6 years. But mm-hmm. Edge really helped him, ditto for Angle at this time.
Mm-hmm.
So that was SummerSlam 2006, everybody. I'm gonna give that show a 5 out of 10.
Okay,
it's a pass.
5 out of 10.
This didn't blow me away, this show. But there was some good stuff.
I thought the in-ring was a pretty good. Good show. I like the Foley Flair match. I like the McMahon match. I like the Edge Cena match even. So I give this one a 7 out of 10.
All right, 7 out of 10. For
wow,
Mr.
we're on
Ting.
A string for of shows where I rank them higher than you. Or is that how it usually works?
Well, yeah. I hated the '89 SummerSlam, and I was chastised for that. Someone called it one of the best events ever.
Okay.
Like, well, I'm sorry.
Everybody has
not enjoy it, but everyone is welcome to disagree.
Absolutely.
These are just our opinions, everyone. Don't shoot us. We'll go into our feedback right now before we transition over to Alex Greenfield. Let's hear what you guys had to say about SummerSlam 2006. And a quick note, it might already be up online. I might have done this already. But we're also going to post the Law episode from that evening, from August of 2006, where you'll get to hear the entire show from that night, see what Dan and Jay had to think of it. At that time period as well, Dave Meltzer on the show. And for you MMA fans, we had Forrest Griffin and Stefan Bonner on that night, 1 week before their rematch at UFC 62. So that's going to be up on the website.
I was there, and I don't remember this at all.
Okay. Well, even more reason for you to listen on the way to Shanghai.
I will be listening.
Bill Thigpen. I don't remember much about this SummerSlam, to be honest with you. I do remember the Orton and Hogan match, though. I remember thinking that Hogan had no business wrestling Randy Orton, let alone anybody. This match had decent heat and an awesome crowd reaction, but it was only for Hogan. Hogan should have never come back in the first place. His days of glory were way behind him, and he should just stay the fuck out of wrestling. But as it is now, we are stuck with this old ass on Impact. The DX versus McMahon's match was fucking awesome. I love seeing the McMahons getting their asses whooped. Altogether, though, when I went back and watched it, I thought it was a fairly decent pay-per-view.
I enjoyed Jason Chapa. I enjoyed Ric Flair and Mick Foley's program based on the real history between the two. With Rick's method of getting Mick to quit. With Rick's method of getting Mick to quit. Being fairly logical. John Cena putting Edge over in the main event and making him even more of a star almost makes up for Hulk Hogan once again going over someone he had no business beating.
We should note that, for those maybe that are not familiar with it, the whole Flair-Foley feud kind of came out of their books, where Foley, in his first book, Have a Nice Day, talked about when Ric Flair was a booker there. Foley was not too happy with Ric Flair, and then Flair came back in his own book calling Mick Foley a glorified stuntman, and so there was some legitimate issues between the two, but they were able to work through them, and they continued that onwards into TNA, of course, and they seem to be on very good terms now. Kieran Roach, I really enjoyed SummerSlam 2006, especially Mick Foley versus Ric Flair, as I didn't expect much going in, and therefore was greatly surprised when it turned out to be one of the best matches of the pay-per-view, with both Flair and Foley doing crazy juice jobs, and Flair acting like a madman was awesome. The Chavo versus Rey match was good, but a bit uncomfortable to watch with the Eddie storyline. Sabu versus Big Show was okay, but did have a lot of botches. Hogan versus Randy was good, even though it would have been better if Hogan had put Randy over. Considering it was Hogan's last WWE match, why not give the crowd what they wanted? The world title match was rubbish with a shit finish, and the main event was pretty good as Edge overcame Super Cena in front of his hometown. All in all, I give this pay-per-view a 7 out of 10, and thank you to John and Way for doing this podcast. Well, thank you. All the way from Ireland is Kieran. And as I noted with Hogan, I mean, it's not like they knew it was his last match. They had plans for him for something bigger at Mania. And the cool part about this was that they did Cena Edge here in Boston, and then the next month in Toronto. Mm. So they got to do kind of like a home-and-home series.
Mm. Ryan Daniels, I really enjoyed the SummerSlam. I remember at the time finding it hard to fault Chavo's reasoning for turning on Rey, and their match was good. I remember the Hogan versus Orton build with Brooks seeming a bit weird, but thought their match was okay. I don't recall giving the finish much thought, but in hindsight, it would have benefited Orton to win far more than what Hogan got out in return from winning the match. I remember being pleased that King Booker retained the world title, as I was loving his gimmick at the time, and also got a kick out of the Mick Foley and Melina friendship that played a role in the conclusion of the I Quit match. Was also loving the return of DX at the time and their war with the McMahons. Finally, I loved Edge slapping Cena's father in the build to their match and thought their match was match of the night. Overall, a good pay-per-view that's still fresh in my mind 5 years later.
Alexander Rios, Raw, SmackDown, and the fake ECW present. A big fat goose egg.
Present.
Present. Whoops. Think I'm being too harsh? Think again. I hated this SummerSlam, vehemently. From the nothing fake ECW title match to the main event itself. Complete garbage. Even in 2006, I was already fed up with Triple H or Shawn versus Vince and or Shane. While the DX return was nice for a pop back in June, it lost its flavor. In a hurry around the 4th of July. Batista versus Booker T was asked backwards to me in terms of booking versus real life, because we all knew that Booker was a stand-up guy that worked hard to get where he got, and Batista was just a flat-out prick. And for this match, I refused to cheer for him. Edge versus John Cena. I'm just glad Edge won. And Randy Orton jobbing blatantly to washed-up Hulk Hogan in his 50s because he was being his usual selfish, arrogant bitch self is beyond disgusting for me. As we all know, Orton could have seriously used the shine, if any left, from Hulk Hogan. And finally, the only good I had from the show was Mick Foley versus Ric Flair. While short, I loved every second of it, especially Flair flipping out and yelling out to Melina, like, I'll kill you too, bitch. But yeah, those are my thoughts on the 06 SummerSlam. Now I need to buy a bottle of vodka after work to wash that down with. Oh, and Hulk Hogan, fuck you.
Okay.
I wonder what Alexander thought about this show.
Yeah. Alan Gaynor. The one memory that sticks up for me most from this show is Orton laying down for what seemed like 5 minutes after a big boot before Hogan hit the leg drop. You'd think he had been shot.
He may have.
Sure, his heart.
By the Hogan leg drop. Joe Bray. SummerSlam was a fairly decent event overall. The only things that really stood out for me looking back at it now is how pissed I was when Hogan went over Orton. At the time, I couldn't understand why Orton didn't win. He was going to be on TV every week, and Hogan would be gone straight away. Plus, Orton was still in his Legend Killer character. The DX return was great for about a month, but I felt it really got old with all this goofy shit every week. I hated the feud with the McMahons, and with the Spirit Squad thrown in, was even worse. The rest of the card was good. I was enjoying the Cena and Edge program, and Foley and Flair match was enjoyable, but a little disturbing. I'd give the show a 7 out of 10.
Abaz Blaze Wally. SummerSlam was one of those SummerSlams where very few things were memorable. Right at the beginning, you knew that Hogan versus Orton would end up in a legend killer who didn't get the job done. I liked how the Mick Foley versus Ric Flair match was leading into SummerSlam, being that they had this off-screen dispute for so many years with Flair calling Foley a glorified stuntman and such. Being a huge Undertaker mark, this was also quite a special SummerSlam since it was the first one since 92 not to feature him.
Devin Clark. SummerSlam 2006 was to me a good pay-per-view. I haven't seen it. But I have seen the entire build-up to the show from all three brands. I was so happy when DX returned 2 months prior. Yeah. Of the three DX runs that they had since 2006, I only liked the 2006 run. I love the McMahon impersonations. I don't like the Hogan-Orton feud at all. The RKO that Orton did to Hogan on a car on the July 15th Saturday night's main event was not cool. ECW was only good in 2006. I absolutely loved the next night's Raw, where Edge introduced the Rated R belt and Jeff Hardy returned after 3 years. Lita threw the Cena belt into the Long Island Sound River. That was the best thing to ever happen to that belt. Personally, I think Booker T was the best King of the Ring in WWE. Those are my thoughts on SummerSlam 2006, the biggest party of the summer. I had only been watching WWE for a year and 1 month when the show took place. I started watching pro wrestling on Tuesday, July the 5th, 2005.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Oh, bro. Sentences are awesome.
Yeah.
Holy shit.
Dennis Amaya. That was fantastic. Dennis Amaya, we want... please, everybody, if you write feedback, be sure to tell us what day and what day of the week it was that you started
Tuesday,
to watch
July
wrestling.
Tuesday, July 5th, 2005.
Mm-hmm. Dennis Amaya, if I remember correctly, SummerSlam 2006 was a very mediocre show that was somewhat saved by two matches. The first match that stands out is Mick Foley and Ric Flair. It was amazing to see two men past their primes who were just destroying themselves to that degree. Their rivalry in this match is full of emotion and was very realistic. The other match that stands out was the Edge versus Cena match. Edge carried John Cena to a good match. Edge was always one of Cena's best opponents. The rest of the show is rather forgettable and boring.
Brad Ward. Chavo versus Rey. Really enjoyed the match, but thought Vicky really took away from the match. However, she is a contrast of how good she has gotten today. Big Show versus Sabu. Really disappointing match. First ECW match at SummerSlam was funny. However, when they showed how much punishment RVD took in the contendership match on ECW television, and Sabu just went through the motions. Hogan versus Randy Orton. Really good start to the last match. Really good start to the Orton character that we do see today. Hulk Hogan's last match with the WWE, as it is known today. Crowd was super over for Hogan. Flair and Mick Foley, really good hardcore match and a great story told on how much aggression that Ric Flair was going to have going into the match. Melina really added to the match and is much better in that role than bitching on Twitter. DX and the McMahons, whatever match, not a fan, just your normal DX squash. Booker Batista, decent match, adding more heat to the program, but was just a match. Edge and Cena, really good back-and-forth match with a creative finish, and like Booker and Batista, it added to the heat of the program. The main event really put over Edge as part of the Billionaire Boys Club. Looking at this pay-per-view and then compare it to 2010 and 2011 with a one-match card, 2011 pales in comparison. Mm-hmm. Yeah, this card, from a marquee standpoint, was name value-wise, was a very deep card. Mm-hmm, I mean, when you have Hogan in the third match, you had Flair Foley...
Batista, Cena, yeah, absolutely. Finally, from Blaine Vandergren, who just had a birthday this weekend. Happy birthday, Blaine. I thought the booking for this show was much better than the actual show. I really enjoyed the Hogan-Orton angle when Orton was hitting on Brooke, but the match just didn't deliver. I also liked the promos of Flair and Foley heading into the pay-per-view, but the finish wasn't the most creative. Rey vs. Chavo was okay, but I didn't care for Vicky's involvement in the end. The McMahons vs. DX sucked. Booker vs. Batista was okay, but with a weak finish. Cena vs. Edge was the feud of the year in 06, in my opinion, and I didn't think the match was disappointing.
All right, well, thanks to everybody for your feedback. You can always leave your own feedback or whatever comments you would like at reviewaway.com. That's reviewaway.com, or simply go facebook.com/reviewaway. And at this point, we're going to transition over to my chat that I did earlier this week with the former lead writer of SmackDown, Alex Greenfield, who is in charge of the writing team on SmackDown heading into this show. Lots of interesting stats coming out of this show and a lot of the behind-the-scenes notes about how this show was shaped on the SmackDown end. Joining us now to get into a bit of a time warp, so to speak, and go back to the summer of 2006, a man that I've wanted to have on this program for quite some time. He is the former lead writer of SmackDown and a man that has had lots and lots of experience under his belt. The man who has a complete IMDb page himself, Alex Greenfield, here joining us. And Alex, thanks a lot for doing this with us.
Thanks so much for having me on, John. It's a pleasure. Well, we're going to take you back to the summer of 2006 because we're taking a look at SummerSlam from that year. But before we chat about that specific event, for listeners who maybe just want to get the time zone right, so to speak, you came into the company right after WrestleMania in 2005, if I'm not mistaken.
A little bit after that. I came in June. I actually applied for the job right after the Raw at Staples Center after WrestleMania.
So it would have been about right around a year that you rose up to become the lead writer on SmackDown, like quite a quick ascension for you. Tell us just a bit about maybe the beginning process, the first 2 to 3 months, because that seems to be the time period where it's kind of the walking on eggshells phase in a very, very unique company in WWE.
Yeah, it certainly wasn't like any other experience I'd ever had. I had a lot of experience coming in, working in advertising and on television shows, and sort of I was, as JBL always called me, I was the prototypical Hollywood dipshit. it was a really interesting experience, because what you just said is what the lady from Human Resources says when you're first hired. Not Steph, not anyone in the power structure, but the Human Resources lady is always saying, well, you know, for the first couple of months, you should just stay quiet and listen and just be an observant little person at the learning tree. And I was absolutely terrible at that. And one of the advantages I have is, you know, when I came on to SmackDown, I was working for Dave Lagana and working with Court Bauer, who are two just really good guys. And their advice was just the opposite, you know, speak up, speak your mind, and don't be intimidated by your Vince or your Steph or whoever those people are. And I sort of got over kind of quickly, at least got over to the degree that I knew I wasn't going to be let go immediately after the 3 month temporary contract. When I pretty quickly got, close is the wrong word, I got into a really good working relationship with Eddie Guerrero, who was notoriously difficult to writers to work with. And we just got along for no readily apparent reason for gangbusters. And I started pitching ideas on the Eddie versus Ray angle we had going on with Dominic coming in and all of that pretty early on, because I sort of come from that serialized storytelling world. And that's really that, in combination with when you work on a show, it's still all hands on deck with working on Raw or ECW when that came along, or that sort of thing, even though my principal area was SmackDown. So the combination of working with Eddie and Ray on the one show, and then Brian Gewirtz assigned me to most of the Mickie James versus Trish Stratus angle on the other show. And between the combination of those, I sort of found a niche, I guess, in the company, and the folks higher up on the ladder seemed to like me all right.
And with the experience you had coming in, was there any room that was similar to the writer's room in WWE, or was this kind of almost alien to any experience you had prior?
No. There is, in fact, a writer's room that is both sort of your typical television show bullpen, where all of the writers have desks and you can shoot the shit about ideas, and we have big whiteboards where we're tracking storylines and angles and ideas for who's going to win and who's going to lose. Usually we tried, at least on a pay-per-view to pay-per-view level, to have those sort of basically arced out from pay-per-view to pay-per-view. But honestly, at WWE, if we got actual 2 weeks of booking in advance done, it was an extremely rare circumstance. But yeah, there's a big writer's room, and every week each of the shows has a meeting with Steph and then a meeting with Steph and Vince. So there's like a big conference table, and there are WWE posters and toys. And I mean, it's the sort of juvenile writer's room that one would expect on just about any show. It's the process of WWE that's very, very different than any other show I've ever worked on.
Now, we're recording this on a Wednesday night. We're just a few nights away from SummerSlam. SmackDown's been shot. We've got 4 matches lined up for SummerSlam right now. Is this a bit of a failure in terms of, what do you envision is going on right now in terms of that? We don't even know what the majority of the card is going to look like on Sunday outside. This really is a one match show going into Sunday.
Yeah, it's extreme. Well, first, let me argue the point because I am and will always be a big mark for Mark Henry. I'm actually really captivated by his push in the Sheamus match. But I agree. I think casual fans are most likely not going to buy for that. So you're right. I guess it is a one match show, but I'm excited for that one. But I suspect they're freaking the heck out. This is unusual that there's no real idea. And clearly they've been floating test balloons with the Morrison Truth stuff and figuring out what they're going to do with Del Rio. Like, there are a lot of places they could go with matches, but really having four advertised matches and only one that's really meant to be a draw is really unusual to me.
Mm-hmm. Now, as we go back now to SummerSlam of 2006, this was a interesting time for you because you were about to be leaving the company almost like a week after this, right?
My wife and I finally, after 9 months after getting married, my wife and I finally took our honeymoon right the 2 weeks after SummerSlam, I think.
Okay.
I got back from that and literally got home, dropped my bags, walked into my office, just my home office, and called Steph and gave notice that day. And then I stuck around until the go home to No Mercy, whenever that was, towards the
end. Oh, okay. September. So
right
October.
Around that time period, the interesting thing to remember is it's also right around the time I got promoted. I was only the head writer for 17 weeks, I think it was, and got the hell out of Dodge. But my main recollection of SummerSlam 2006 is actually that it comes immediately after the Great American Bash of 06. Yes. Which
one of your favorite shows, I understand.
Oh, the worst pay-per-view of all time. And the first one I was the lead writer producer on. It was just terrible. And just looking over the card, I sort of got a little cheat sheet just to make sure I remembered everything. It occurs to me that our two big matches on the card, the Batista versus Booker and Chavo versus Rey, were both a month early because of the events at Great American Bash, at losing Bobby and the Great Kali, and that whole angle with him and Undertaker, and the Dave Batista Mark Henry angle was supposed to be terminating here with a cage match, which obviously didn't happen because Mark hurt his leg at Saturday night's main event. Everything just got screwed. So we're literally our two major matches on this card were supposed to have been at No Mercy or later. It was a very stressful time.
So yeah, and that was one of the topics I definitely wanted to ask, was that it was on the go home show for SummerSlam that we saw the Undertaker and Kali work together, and no Undertaker on this pay-per-view. Was that just the angle wasn't ready to peak for SummerSlam? It was a matter of slots on the pay-per-view?
No, more the opposite, really. It was the Punjabi prison match at the Great American Bash was supposed to be the Great Kali and the Undertaker, and sort of the next step in that. Because look, a lot of people can talk absolutely about how limited Kali is, and I'm not going to make a big argument about that. But we really liked the build, and in fairness, Lagana started it. But we really liked the build of getting this fear that finally the Undertaker's has someone to be afraid of. And then everything shit the bed because of a wellness test that, in fact, and for the record, both Bobby and Kali actually had done nothing wrong with the wellness policy. It was bad testing and nothing else, but it completely destroyed the angles. We were going to go with the Undertaker and Kali at SummerSlam, and it was a big argument about cutting for time. And that's the match that got cut. Vince wanted to blow off the angle, so he did the, I think it was a last man standing on that go home SmackDown.
Yeah, and we don't have to make this a great Kali love fest, but he was brought in so well. And I remember it was the Judgment Day show where Kali just went over Undertaker clean. And it was so unselfish of Taker really making this guy in one night. Like, people might, you know, look at Kali now, but he was hot coming in because of that match, in my opinion.
Absolutely. And that's huge credit to Taker, who really is just, he's one of those guys who's a real pleasure to work with. work in a professional context. I've never worked a day in my life in a wrestling context, but that was his idea. A lot of ideas were floated around with the agent, who I think was Arn Anderson, and talking with Vince directly. And I mean, for conversations at that level, even then, I sat there as a fly on the wall and just listened to the grown-ups talk, you know. But Taker was just like, no, he's got to go over clean, and then I can take my time off to get well, and you just keep building this guy, and then I'll come back hero on a white horse. And first Dave, and then I like to think myself, really did a good job building that, and just that situation beyond your control came up, and it's why serialized storytelling is so hard in professional wrestling, because shit happens, pardon my language. And you can lose track of things. And it was a bummer because we really loved the build with Khali. And huge credit, too, to Dave Kapoor. He came in right after WrestleMania and speaks Punjabi. And he sat down with Taker before he was ever a character on the show. He was working backstage with Taker and Khali as a translator and really helped their stuff come together, I thought, fantastically.
Yeah, I think Taker's always, especially in the last 5 years, has really understood the value of, you know, you get laid out, you do the big sell, and it's going to make the comeback that much more impressive because it's something that the audience gets behind. And it was something that I've always felt kind of Hunter missed out on, because it just seemed I never believed this guy being vulnerable. It was, this guy was always put in positions where he never did look weak, and therefore you couldn't really get the heat on another guy. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. And I completely agree about Hunter. It's sort of, and obviously, look, they're playing both sides of the fence right now, but I've never believed in front of or behind the curtain Hunter in any sort of babyface way at all. That's just not him. And Frank, like, somehow the Undertaker, who we all know is completely invulnerable, can give more of a great Ricky Morton sense of baby-face vulnerability than Hunter's ever been able to do in his greatest shine, you know?
Now, looking at the main program on SmackDown at the time going into there, it was King Booker, phenomenal gimmick. I mean, this really gave this guy an entirely new lease on his career at the time, taking on Batista. And of course, this was really heightened with the photo shoot, which JBL even snuck in on commentary on this show to bring up.
Yeah, no. And that was, dude, that was an awkward night, too. The night after the photo show, I think we were in Anaheim. I'm not 100% sure. And they had done the photo shoot in L.A., and we started hearing about it at the taping prior to any of the people who'd been at the shoot coming back. And we finally hear the whole story. In fact, it was JBL got there first, and a bunch of us are standing around, and he's telling us, oh, my God, they got in this huge fight and this whole deal. And then Batista comes back, and I hadn't seen Dave in – I don't remember when it was he got hurt, but in quite a few months. So I'm like, hey, man, how's it going? And his face is bruised up, and Booker comes a little bit later and his face is bruised up. And we slowly start hearing the story. And, dude, it was just the most awkward couple of days, because these are two guys who, again, at that point, when they actually did the photo shoot, this match wasn't still supposed to happen for another couple of months. It was supposed to be this SummerSlam 2006 that Booker was going to beat Ray, and the Chavo turn was going to happen. And obviously everything got pushed up so much earlier because of various injuries and people dropping out and wellness tests and all of that. But yeah, the Booker versus Batista thing, there was some, these guys are both professionals, and nobody I ever met at WWE was somebody who I would ever have had a concern was going to full on shoot in a match. But there was definitely talk backstage and in the writers' rooms of like, could this match go south or anything like that? And look, ultimately, I don't think it was a great match, and I still would have rather seen what we were originally going to do. But they, you know, they both acted as absolute gentlemen and professionals. But boy, talk about cold professionalism backstage. It was not comfortable until shortly before I left, at which point they were back to laughing and talking again.
Yeah. So I guess
you've kind of explained it, that this was kind of pushed up a month to SummerSlam because, yeah, as you mentioned, like a very flat finish for this match, just kind of the cheap DQ, which on a major pay-per-view, you have to know that the audience, it is going to shit on a finish like
that. Oh, yeah. Yeah, and that's another of the things. And I mean, sort of the way this all was handled. I mean, this is where, you know, I've gotten in my share of shouting matches with Vince, and it was all of the stuff transitioning from Ray to Booker as champion and rushing this angle and all of that, that we were screaming at each other every week. And ultimately, it's as much one of the reasons, just the constantly having to fight every day, is as much a reason why I quit as anything else, and which I will totally take chicken shit heat for. and accept completely. But essentially, and I always feel like, you know, it's shoveling blame off. I was the head writer of the show, and I could have fought harder and longer and whatever. But essentially, you know, we were debuting on the CW network. We wanted the first time Booker and Batista touched each other to be on screen on that show to try and draw ratings for our first big night. And Vince was just adamant. At that point, we wanted, I think after Mark got hurt, we thought he and that is Dave Bautista and Ken Kennedy had just an out of the blue, fantastic freaking match at Great American Bash. And we wanted to go somewhere with that. And about 2.5 weeks before, Vince just said, nope, we're going with Booker. And for a while, he wanted to switch the title again, one pay-per-view later. Wow. And chilled out on that. But we didn't decide the exact finish, I think, until the agents meeting, which is sort of a pre-production meeting before the show starts that day. And yeah, even agents in the room, I think Hayes and Arn and Fit were all like, that's really flat. And Vince said, what else are we going to do? We've got to run with this till whatever it was, a Survivor Series, I guess, or Cyber Sunday.
Yeah, and that's kind of interesting. Like, as the writing team, kind of, this is the direction we're going in. Are you guys pretty much independent of how the match is worked out and finish? I mean, how much input do you get when perhaps a finish like that is thrown at you? Are you guys kind of, your hands are tied at that point?
We can certainly make the argument. And again, one of the things, you know, and different writers handle it different ways. Some much more, you know, Court Bauer was always good at playing this game of mental jujitsu that would make especially Vince think that he'd come up with an idea that Court had come up with. And it was amazing. He used the frickin' force. I ended up in shouting matches with Vince, and when a finish changes, I remember, this is one of those questions that you need someone like Lagana with the frickin' photographic memory to remember.
Yeah.
There was one night on SmackDown that a finish in a match changed. Oh, it was during the Undertaker Randy Orton angle where they did the burning of the casket and all of that. I think that
previous
fall. And somehow Taker and Randy were on SmackDown. And between the agents meeting, and we'd always been building on the aspect that on the idea that Taker or Randy has the Undertaker's number. He is the better man. He's got the key. And somehow the finish on the show, which was going to see Randy Orton prove once again that he could beat the Undertaker until obviously Taker would ultimately win, somehow. And the story I heard was Pat Patterson didn't like that finish. Went and talked to Vince and Taker about it and convinced them to change it such that the Undertaker went over Randy Orton clean in the middle of a program that still had two pay-per-views to go.
Wow.
And there was nothing we could do about it because sometimes you don't even know. But in terms of mechanically, we very rarely get into the specific physicality unless there's a reason for us to have something creatively that happens, like somebody uses a ladder when we're trying to set up a ladder match down the line, or, you know, sort of basic things like that. For the most part, we more or less decide who goes over in consultation with Vince, and then the working out of the matches for the boys involved or the girls involved and their specific agent.
Now, we did mention Ray Chavo was the other big program on the SmackDown end going into this show. The previous month, of course, Ray dropped the title to Booker, and I think a lot of people were responding well to Ray as champion.
Yeah.
How much did you, Like, it seemed that Vince was completely adamant when the title was put on Ray that the clock starts ticking now till we take the title off of him. As a writer at that point, do you think that, you know, I'm not going to die on this hill for this argument if Vince is so adamant? I mean, what was the process of until you just got to the point that the title's coming off because that is what Vince wants?
I did die on that hill, basically. I mean, that was the beginning of the end. And I mean, I think some other guys have talked about this, like Bruce Pritchard was there and Dusty Rhodes and a bunch of Vince and I came as close to blows as we ever would have. And make no mistake, I'm no tough guy. He would have kicked the shit out of me, but we came as close to blows as we ever did about the build of Ray as champion and him just insisting on all of those insipid, oh, I'm just so fortunate to be the champion and I'm just a lucky guy. All of that just killed me. You know, I like I said, I love Mark Henry, but we crushed him with Mark. We crushed Ray with Khali. We just crushed him again and again. And we still increased our ratings, especially in Latino demographics, but all across, we increased our ratings with Ray. And Vince just would not listen to that. And he really did. He had booked taking the title off of Ray at the time that he won the title. It was just incredibly frustrating. And here's a fun fact. It was originally going to go to John Layfield. I forget the exact which show it was, but Ray was going to go over John at whatever the pay-per-view after WrestleMania is. And then John was going to beat him the next night. But that's when John got the MRI done and he saw, you know, his back was in really rough shape at that point. So that actually bought Ray another pay-per-view as champion.
Wow. And that was
decided before WrestleMania. That was decided on the day of the Hall of Fame.
Wow.
Of WrestleMania 22.
And now with JBL here, you guys kind of just stumbled into this where JBL ends up on the desk with Michael Cole. And we have seen some examples in the past of guys who are great promos that it doesn't always translate to commentary. Very different in terms of how you're presenting yourself. And JBL, I would say a couple weeks in, was just hitting home runs on this show. And it brought Michael Cole's game up. And the commentary, I thought, was a highlight of SmackDown every week.
Absolutely. I thought it was tremendous. It bummed me out because I love, you know, I really dig the JBL character. I love working with John, and it sucked not having him as a week in, week out talent. I still think to this day that match where he finally beat Lashley for the title at No Way Out, I think, still yes. One of Lashley's two or three best matches ever. Like, this was a guy like The Undertaker. You know, he's got the rep as a bully, and hell yeah, he is one. But he's also a guy who loves the business and loves getting younger talent over, and it was great. But boy, goddamn, once he got on the desk, that commentary team, that's a commentary team I'd absolutely put up against. Well, if I could have him and JR, I've told him this. If I could have him and JR, it would be the best commentary team ever.
How in terms of, we always hear the stories about kind of Vince McMahon on the announcers. I mean, how did he take to JBL?
Really good. The difficulty, he likes to produce the announcers a lot, and he mostly stayed off JBL after the first couple of weeks because John just had fantastic instincts. But, and frankly, it was a rib by both of us. John and I, whenever we would be on the plane together, JBL and I, I'm a total pinko liberal. And John is a pretty hardcore conservative, though not as conservative as he would have you folks in the public think. We would literally get shit-faced drunk on the plane and just argue politics and bore everyone else to tears the entire flight. Like, it was ridiculous. So we started doing this thing where we would start slipping into commentary, political commentary, sort of to fuck with Vince. And Vince would call him on that. Like, I remember we were doing what did we call Kid Cash and Jamie?
The
Pitbulls? No.
It was some version of the Pitbulls.
Yeah.
I think it was.
Anyway, John.
The Dixie flag and yeah.
Yeah. John would always bust in with the, you know, these guys are so conservative. They make Strom Thurmond look like, I can't even remember what it was, but we would just start throwing in more and more political jokes. And Vince would get all over his case for that. God damn it, John, you can't do that, because I'm always sitting in commentary or in Gorilla next to them for most of SmackDown every week. Dusty Rhodes and I were up there because the lead writer is pretty much always in Gorilla, and it would drive Vince up a tree the way we try and slip politics in.
If I'm not mistaken, there was one match where JBL put in a David Dukes reference for those.
Yes, yes, exactly. Oh,
and I was shocked that made TV.
Yep.
Wow. That was the one where I was like, my God, I can't believe they let that reference in. But I remember.
I can't believe he didn't cut more out. And I'm pretty sure there are a few because we had the advantage on SmackDown 9 out of 10 times we are an edited show. So we would change things. I mean, we certainly did with matches if moves are botched or whatever. I'm sure it must kill the live audience for SmackDown because we will, the ref will get a call and he'll just have the guys do a spot again. It must have driven them crazy because, live show, you miss a spot, you just move on to the next thing. On SmackDown, we would have people do it again because you can edit. And there were times that JBL got edited, but for the most part, obviously, we left the David Dukes thing in. How far can we go?
He got Fedor in, I think, one week, too, at that point.
It wouldn't surprise me. I don't remember that. It's funny. I actually only became a mixed martial arts fan sort of after I left. Court Bauer really turned me on to it. But at that point, I don't think I would have caught a Fedor reference.
Just going back to the Ray Chavo angle, tell us a bit about just the delicate process at that point, because Eddie was certainly a part of this storyline, but not to the degree right after his death, which to a person I've spoken to left a really bad taste in their mouth. And in this, it was more or less these two are fighting for Eddie's honor at the time, a much toned down version of what was presented right after his death.
It was very uncomfortable backstage for a lot of this stuff. Uncomfortable even more than in most, Vince was absolutely convinced, and I suspect if whenever he passes away, we'll expect that they make an angle about him. He was convinced that Eddie would support this, and he's the one who was very, very adamant about, dedicating the title run to Eddie, and Eddie this and Eddie that. To his credit, he's the one who, Vicky's the one who pitched coming in as a character, and she's the one who pitched her own heel turn, and that made us uncomfortable. And what I didn't realize at the time, and what I think history has borne out, is the discomfort we felt from that made her a great heel character. And correct me if I'm wrong, but her involvement in the angle starts right about here.
Yeah, it did. She was on this show. She did the run-in, basically, yeah, that led to Ray losing the match. And, I mean, did you see something at that early point with Vicky of what she would eventually evolve into?
I saw it, and this sounds like I'm trying to take some kind of credit for it. This is all Vicky. I saw it. We were talking. I produced the Hall of Fame segment at WrestleMania that year. I was just the producer sort of making all the trains go on time.
Uh-huh.
And I got to talking with Vicky the night before at the Hall of Fame, just shooting the breeze. And I heard her evil laugh, like her sort of self-consciously, mwahaha, evil laugh. And I was like, my God, that's good. We should get that version of Vicky on screen. And she looked at me with this big smile and a twinkle in her eye and just nodded. And I was like, God damn, there's something there. And anyway, a few months later, after we'd done the Chavo turn, but before she was directly involved, she was like, I'd like to be involved in this and maybe turn. And Vince was super resistant to, nobody's ever going to boo Vicky Guerrero. It's never going to happen. And it took a real process of a lot of people. Hayes was a big proponent of it. Court was. Like, a lot of people had to talk Vince into letting her be a heel. And to me, it's totally paid off. I think the moon and stars about Vicky Guerrero.
A lot of our listeners sent in some questions. Do you have some time here, Alex? I know we've already gone over time here. All right, we'll start off here with Shay Avigan, all the way from Israel here, and he wants to know the story involving Palmer Cannon and if it was in fact due to a hazing incident.
That's an interesting story. The story of Palmer Cannon is we were just sitting around in a bull session one day and we were about to change networks. And I said, what if somebody brings a network guy in? And a person more familiar with the indies than I can't remember who it was like, oh, didn't ECW do something like that? And I was like, I don't know, but I'm seeing this guy as like a slick CAA agent type, you know, just sort of the douchebags I work with. We got to talking about it and we liked the idea of creating an antagonist who had parity with Vince, somebody who could look Vince in the eye and say, well, sort of do a deal they did years later with Regal when Regal cut somebody off by just saying, go to commercial. We want our idea initially was to build Cannon to the degree that Vince comes out and makes one of Vince's, you know, crazy pronouncements or whatever it is. And Palmer says, actually, our demographic data doesn't really agree with that, Vince. And Vince starts to do his I'm the boss, I'm the owner of WWE. And Cannon just snaps his finger and it cuts to black because he's the actual network. And Vince loved that idea. He thought it would be a really cool thing for about a week. And then after we debuted Palmer and started the NTI, the New Talent Initiative, Vince was like, well, I'd never say yes to anyone from a network. I'm my own boss. He just suddenly hated the idea. Anyway, he started pushing to get Palmer working. And I mean, look, Brian, the actual guy, it was a perfectly fine worker. So they went on a European tour and this is where stories sort of shift. The story that we heard coming back was he got pissed about some kind of bullshit hazing, and JBL got a lot of the blame for it and walked off, never to return, just said, fuck this, I don't have the time. Now, I have no idea what that incident was, but I did get drunk with JBL one time, and I was like, all right, buddy, tell me what really happened. And what he said to me makes perfect sense, at least to me. He was like, was there hazing? Sure, but it's nothing any worse than I did to you. And all he ever did to me was I think he gave me a chop once and we got too drunk a couple of times and yelled at each other a lot. So is that hazing that warrants quitting or not? I don't know. And is that the true, whole and unadulterated story? I don't know. But I can tell you, I was super bummed to see Brian and the Palmer Cannon character go away because he was a good guy. And I think we could have done a lot with the storyline.
Well, maybe he'll show up as the mysterious network executive on Impact.
Yeah, he could, in fact, be the mysterious network executive. And he would do great in the role. And somebody, I think it was Court, told me he's either training in or has had a couple of fights in mixed martial arts recently.
Oh, really? I
can't remember where
that.
It was, but I think up in the Boston area.
We go over to Dennis Amaya. He wants to know what the plans were for Bobby Lashley that summer and how popular Mr. Kennedy was at the time to the creative team, essentially. Plans for Mr. Kennedy during that summer.
Oh, I'm a huge Kennedy fan. We were at the time. We knew we had lightning in a bottle from when he was doing the promos on Tony Chimmel, we totally dug the guy. And at that point, after the match with Dave, he came out of nowhere and they worked, to me, the best match on the Great American Bash that year. And man, we were so high on Kennedy that we had him slated to win Money in the Bank. That summer, we knew where we were going with him. And we planned actually, I sort of did a master grid for a year in advance. We originally planned on having Kennedy cash in and beat The Undertaker at SummerSlam. This was obviously barring all manner of injuries and shit like that happened after I left. But we were really high on Kennedy for sure. What was the other half of the question? I'm sorry.
Bobby Lashley, the plans for him that summer?
He was going to this is what I mean about Batista not actually arriving in that title picture with Booker until originally Survivor Series was the idea, was to just tease them and keep them apart. Remember, Bobby had to kiss the feet of Booker. He was going to end up being the initial superhero to stop Booker. He was going to face him again at Great American Bash. Then there was going to be then Booker would get the shot at Ray, end up winning the title. We'd go back in some kind of book gimmick match to Bobby and Booker at No Mercy. And that's sort of where we lost sight of it. But we saw the three sort of top baby faces outside of Undertaker, who's kind of his own deal, you know, as Batista, Booker, and Ray, or rather Batista, Bobby, and Ray on SmackDown.
This one comes from Jay Hunter in Ireland. How long typically were creative meetings, and when were scripts finalized? On average, how many rewrites were there, and are writers ever paired with specific wrestlers? So a couple questions in there.
Yes. First, writers are almost always paired with specific wrestlers, because if nothing else, it helps you get their voice, because when you're trying to write things for them, and write ideas for them, you want to be sort of in line with their characters. So I sort of already told you, you know, I was initially assigned to Ray and Eddie and JBL on SmackDown when I first started as a writer. And Mickey and Trish, obviously, in women's angles generally on Raw. And new writers come in and you try and get them with specific talents, both so they sort of learn the ropes with someone safe and so that they can get the voice right when you're trying to write for someone. And it works in different ways with different people. There were so many parts to that question. God. Writers meetings. The real answer is they never end. I was just talking with Court the other day about, you know, back when we were at WWE, you're never really off the clock. Like, I remember having phone calls about creative with other guys on the team at 1 a.m. and getting into the office at 9 and just starting right up again. If you mean the formal weekly writers meetings, they often last 2 to 3 hours, more or less, like the ones with Vince where you're pitching creative. And there's no way of telling on rewrites. Like, there is no average length. I've had shows that first draft to air, very few things changed. And we've had plenty of shows where you're changing shit on the fly during the show.
Just going back to the Ray Eddie program from that summer of 2005, was the success of that program really kind of your first sort of I guess badge of honor, so to speak, because I remember the quarter hours for that, and you guys would bring in like well over 1 million viewers for those segments. Yeah. I mean, just an incredible gain.
When we got the rating for the Eddie on the Top of the Ladder storybook one, I wish I could remember the number for you, but we were just through the roof. Like, it was so awesome. They just nailed it. We were drawing viewers over the course of the quarter hour. It was just fantastic. And that's all credit to Eddie and Ray and everyone involved in the angle. Like, they kicked ass, and it was super. Yeah. Working with Eddie's stamp of approval is what made me with that company. Absolutely. No question.
And then you had, of course, Dominic in there. And of course, a few years later, they used his daughter for the CM Punk angle. It was like, Jesus Christ, like these kids alone are like unbelievable.
I know, right? And Dominic was always great, man. Like, he was fun to produce. He was really engaged. He and Ray just have the best chemistry. And he, Ray, and Eddie backstage just had the best chemistry in the world. You know, he was. I won't speak for family, but it felt like, you know, watching a kid with his uncle, him backstage, when he would go out and say these horrible things to him and all of that. But they were, you know, super well adjusted. Like, it was a lot of fun working on that angle because, again, it appealed to I come out of serialized storytelling, and that's that type of storytelling as opposed to just sort of traditional booking in the classical sense. So it was a lot of fun to work on, and yeah, it absolutely sort of made my bones, I guess, with the company.
Next question is from Thulani, who wanted to know if there was any thought of going with Chavo as the top babyface following Eddie's death, rather than kind of Ray in that role heading into WrestleMania.
Strangely, no. No, it never he was seen as an important supporting character. And I love Chavo, but it was never seriously discussed. Like, it felt like the torch passing to Ray was the right thing to do from the beginning. Whether or not Ray would become champion or not was an object of much debate. But we always sort of saw Ray in that role.
Steve Kassan says, I'm an aspiring screenwriter myself, and I wanted to know how a SmackDown and or Raw script is formatted. Is it under regular television formats or script formats? And also, how does the match time determine the length of a segment, such as with including promos?
In answer to the second question first, it's sort of cart before the horse. As we're going through and timing out the show, we're thinking to ourselves about what each segment needs to run. So if we know we want to have a big two segment match for the crossover, you know, sort of from, you know, 8:50 to 9:10 or whatever, what we're thinking about is who to position in that match that it's going to draw eyeballs or that sort of thing. And, you know, we try to pay attention to the ratings first off. So if Eddie and Ray talking is drawing like it's drawing, we're going to keep going to that well as much as we can. But outside of that, we know sometimes we're tight on a show and maybe we can do some sort of 3-minute match that gets someone over strong, but it's really about the timing. It's really about the match first and then the timing. We can make the timing work if we have something important to do. And in terms of formatting, it's the closest thing I've seen to it is a live television run sheet. If you know formatting, that's what it looks like. So it doesn't have blocks of dialogue and action like a narrative television script. No.
And the last listener question is from Dave Power, who just wants to know your best achievement during that time as lead writer, whether it be storyline or a specific angle.
Oh, my best achievement as lead writer. Well, obviously, if ignoring the creation of the Punjabi prison match, the greatest of all professional wrestling matches.
Hey, that's it's a great achievement. That will always be remembered.
If we can ignore that for a moment, I really feel like, and look, it's always funny because I can't take credit for it. This is the boys, but I loved King Booker. I loved his court, Finley and Regal working together. I loved Charmel. I loved everything about King Booker and his court. I thought that was really, really fun, entertaining television, and it seems like viewers agreed.
Did you hear that they're going to be doing a King of the Ring DVD, and he's going to be hosting it as King Booker?
Oh, outstanding. I have not heard that. That's great.
Yeah, it's going to be fantastic. Well, before we let you go, Alex, I just quickly want to get your thoughts on the CM Punk angle. I know a lot of our listeners listen to I Want Wrestling, and right after the big promo in June, a lot of you guys were on with Dave Lagana discussing all the possibilities as we're going into SummerSlam right now. What are your thoughts and how they followed this up over the last month?
Look, I mean, you can Monday morning quarterback all day long, and Lord knows I do. I've spent more time on the phone bullshitting with people about professional wrestling since CM Punk did the incredible shoot promo. I've spent more hours talking about wrestling since when I worked at WWE. So no matter what else you say about it, it's got me talking about it and thinking about it and excited about wrestling for the first time in this kind of way, literally since the Austin McMahon stuff, which is the last time, you know, including working at the frickin' company. It's just so much fun. I have no idea where it's going to go on Sunday. I can see them. My worst case scenario is, you know, Punk ends up winning, keeping his title with Hunter's help, and it's revealed that he and Hunter have been in league all the time. Like, anytime Hunter's involved in an angle, I assume the worst. But, you know, I hope it's something awesome. There are 100 ways it can go, and all I can say is I absolutely love how excited the whole angle still has me about wrestling.
Well, Alex, it's been a pleasure chatting with you. I would love to have you back on sometime because there's tons of stuff to talk about. I'm always a big fan of catching your interviews wherever they may be. And what do you have coming up in the next little while that you'd like to promote where people can
I'm doing pretty awesome right now. I set up a 1-hour drama at Fox Television Studios that we're out to talent right now. You sort of attach the two lead roles before we take it into the network. But that's super freaking exciting. I've been doing a lot of work with Amazon Studios lately. I've got a team together and we've won like $40,000. Basically, Amazon.com has created what amounts to a movie studio, and they're starting that out with a contest for writers and filmmakers. And it's pretty awesome. In fact, I was talking to a buddy earlier about they have a contest running right now that any armchair bookers who want to be writers out there should get in on. You can rewrite a script called Zombies versus Gladiators.
Oh, wow.
Sort of ancient armchair booking. And if you do the best rewrite by the end of August, you get $10,000. It's a pretty cool deal. And it's fun to sit and write about zombies and gladiators. You know, I give them lucha masks or gimmicks or something, get some midgets in there and we're good to go. But you really, it's a really neat opportunity for people who are trying to break into writing. And we've had a great time working on it. And I'm working on a pitch with a former WWE champion for a travel adventure show. Sort of not the thing that you would expect from an ex wrestler, but it's pretty cool. And I will definitely have more to say that once we start taking it around, but we're still in the real early phases.
And you're on Twitter as well?
I am on Twitter at Alex D. Greenfield. And you can hear my thoughts on wrestling mostly and movies and books and all the normal stuff that I think is important that none of you should at all.
Oh, and the last thing was, what's the status right now of the Frank Shamrock project that you and Court were working on?
Yeah. I worked, that's Court and Frank's baby. I know they're in talks. They've been wrapping post-production on the pilot, which is what we shot in February. And I sort of just was acting as a producer on that. But it's a super cool show. I think Court has locked up the cut, and they're in the process of talking to a couple of networks about picking it up. But it's super cool. It's sort of a behind – looking through Frank's eyes, a behind-the-scenes in mixed martial arts show. And it's certainly – we couldn't have asked for a more interesting time with Strikeforce being gobbled up by UFC to get some really interesting material that I think a lot of people are going to love.
Yeah, it's an amazing just time period here for Strikeforce, and you guys were kind of right there behind the scenes with Frank. So I know we're all looking forward to that as well. And Alex, definitely want to have you on sometime in the future, and thanks a lot for doing this tonight.
Thank you so much, John. It was a blast.
So a big thank you to Alex Greenfield for joining us. You can follow him on Twitter at Alex D. Greenfield, and I would love to have that guy come back on the show sometime. It was a lot of fun chatting with Alex about the behind the scenes of the WWE at that time, a very interesting time. Pretty much any time you're on the writing team, you're going to have lots of insight into the product. So
absolutely.
Some cool stuff their way, and that's going to wrap us up here for some for 3 weeks.
Oh, well, the show's will be continued to be of stellar quality.
Yes, you will. Maybe you'll check in with us at some point.
Maybe I will. I'll definitely still be active on the Facebook group. So shoot me a message at facebook.com/way0937. And who knows? Maybe I'll even update my own Twitter once in a while.
Oh my God!
At Way WAI 0937.
There you go. Follow Way on his big worldwide tour, and he will be back here September 4th. But in the meantime, we will continue on with Review Away, Review a Raw, and Review an Impact. I have 3 guest reviewers, 1 for each set of shows. And just tune in, and you'll find out who is going to be chatting wrestling with me for 3 weeks.
Who?
And it's not one person. 3 individuals.
3 very unique individuals that I feel like, we won't say anymore.
So me and the mystery reviewer, we're going to be chatting the 1995 Fall Brawl event for next week. He chose this. I don't even want to say he. We're going to be chatting the 1995 Fall Brawl event that the mystery reviewer selected. That's what they want to review. So that's what we're going to take a look at next week. And as we say goodbye to Mr. Ting for the next 3 weeks.
Well, before we do, we should point everybody to our extra chat with Sebastian Suave that is now available on the iTunes.
Yes, right? It is. We posted that up on earlier this week. Sebastian Suave, a local independent talent that you and I have gotten to see numerous times. I definitely encourage everyone to go check these out. Me and Wei are trying to do a lot more of these in-studio interviews. Yeah. I've enjoyed the two we've done thus far.
I really enjoyed the chat, and I would think... for me, it was just very interesting getting to know what it's actually like for somebody just starting out, and what you know, basically the struggles of an independent wrestler. For anybody who's even curious, you know, we talk about things like what goes into a package that you send to the Fed, and you know, how people make their bookings, and just a lot of interesting philosophies behind pro wrestling that Sebastian was able to give us. So I recommend that.
So you can get that interview and all of our lost shows on iTunes. Just simply search for Live Audio Wrestling, and you can subscribe there. Leave a comment for us if you would like. And as well, you can also get all of our shows at liveaudiowrestling.com. Follow us on Twitter, at Law Radio, at Way0937. We're going to be back on Monday night with Review of Raw and one of our mystery reviewers. So until then, thanks a lot for listening, everybody. And Way, a song to go out here. As you say goodbye.
I was not prepared for this. This was your pick.
Well, I'm throwing it out at you here. It's a curveball.
You know what? Let me go to my MP3 player and let me see what I have. I'm going to pick a song at random. And you know what? I'm just going to hit shuffle. And I'm going to hit play. And, oh boy, this is weird. This song is called Sad Songs by the Alessi Brothers. Enjoy.
Well, it is a sad song because we're going to miss Wei Ting for 3 weeks.
And that was just by random. Funny. Life is random.
No, it's not.
Early in the morning, today I am moving away. Sitting here for the last time makes me feel so strange. My life here is ending like a pulled up wheel. Oh, don't play no sad song, they'll make me cry. The situation reminds me of when I went away to school. My friends, they all called me and said I've been made a fool. My girlfriend, she left me for my best friend. Oh, don't play no sad songs, they'll make me cry. They'll make me cry.